Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. India's northeast state of Assam is suffering through its worst communal violence in more than a decade. Clashes broke out in July between indigenous Bodo tribes and Bengali-speaking Muslims. The conflict escalated this month. 85 people have been killed so far. About 400,000 residents have been forced to flee their homes and are living in makeshift camps. This time, the violence is threatening to spill over to other states in the isolated region. There are social, political, and economic repercussions across India, from Calcutta across to Mumbai and all the way down to Bangalore. And this time, there's a social media catalyst for the violence. Twitter and Facebook postings, fanned by wild rumors and falsehoods, are causing broad internet restrictions. Today's guest is a veteran journalist who will provide intriguing insights into this complicated conflict. Subir Bamuk is a BBC's former bureau chief for East and Northeast India. Subir, who is joining us by telephone from Calcutta, is the author of two books about conflicts in the region. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask first, you know, many of us know India as the world's largest democracy, a melting pot of cultures and regions that takes pride in its tolerance and secular government. But you wrote in one of your books that Northeast India has been seen as a problem child since its very inception, the very inception of the Indian Republic. Can you give us a very brief history lesson on this region and how the past is playing into this flare-up?
Well, to make a very complex problem sound relatively simple for your audiences, there has been two types of conflicts in Northeast. One, of course, is the conflict between the Indian central or federal authority and various different ethnic communities who, after the independence of the country, thought that they had every business to be independent themselves because their forefathers have never lived under any Indian administration, under any Indian dispensation, until the coming of the British. So they would argue, like the Nagas, for instance, the Naga tribes, they said that if the British leaving India and giving India its independence, they should also be independent. And that led to the rise of ethnic separatist movements, first in the Naga Hills and then in other parts of the Northeast. So that was a problem that fed on the contradiction between India's grandiose nation-building project and, of course, the perception of these ethnic communities that they have very little in common with what they felt was the Indian mainland. And therefore, you know, they organized themselves into militant groups, armed groups that fought against the Indian security forces. The second layer of conflict, David, was between various communities in the region, between the Assamese and the Bengali speakers, between, you know, the Nagas and the Kukis, the various different sort of ethnic groups who have conflicting visions of homeland, you know, and there has been these kind of conflicts that have festered in the Northeast. So this is the reason why I've said the Northeast is a problem child of the Republic, because in Northeast, these conflicts have never really gone away. They've festered, they've continued.
Right.
I mean, gone up and down a bit from time to time, but never really gone away.
Now let's set the stage here a bit and talk about the geography of this region. It's sort of I've heard it called the chicken neck of India. Can you explain why the position of this state is also part of the problem?
Well, David, actually, Northeast India is a directional category. It was never a region. It was a frontier of the British Empire because and this place was called Northeast because it was northeast of Bengal, which was the seat of British power for a very, very long time. And in 1837, a British official, Alexander Mackenzie, first used the term Northeastern Frontier. But then from a frontier, this whole region became a constituent region of the Indian Republic. I think the way the partition of the subcontinent took place actually created this region, because there are parts of this region which have nothing in common with each other. You know, Assam is very different from Manipur or Tripura or some of the other hill regions. But then what happened was the way the British divided this subcontinent, they gave away eastern Bengal to Pakistan, and that became East Pakistan. Now, that left northeastern states of India hanging to India through this very small 20-odd kilometer wide corridor, which is called the Chicken Neck.
Right.
Now this, David, is a region where actually India gets to look, not just, in geographical terms, hang on to India through this very small corridor that is flanked by Bhutan and Nepal, and China is not too far away on the one hand to the north, and to the south it's Bangladesh. So this corridor goes through between these three countries connects to what is today's India's northeast.
And you just returned from there. Could you talk about what you saw there?
Right. Now, this whole problem that started in July, the riots between the indigenous Bodo tribes people and the Bengali-speaking Muslims, or Muslims of Bengali origin, I would call it, and I'll clarify that in a moment. These are Muslims of Bengali origin whose ancestors came from what is today's Bangladesh. They were brought into Assam by the British first to grow more food, because they are seasoned agriculturists, they are good farmers, they're tough guys. And they were brought in because they knew settled agriculture. And, then their population has grown over a period of time, and indigenous groups have accused the government of India of not actually putting the brakes on this continuous movement of people from what is today's Bangladesh into the northeast. So they say there is a serious illegal migration problem. Something like Americans often talk about, Mexico. I mean, you have this problem there.
Right.
But the problem here is much more serious, for the very simple reason that this migration, this population movement, has gone on for a very long time. And now Assam is one of the most densely populated states in India. There's very little land actually left. And therefore, there is a huge competition for possession of land. But it's not just land. India is a democracy, as you said when you started the program. In a democracy, numbers count. So in a democracy like India, if you really find people from some other country, from some other region coming into your own region, and their numbers getting to be very big.
The chief minister, he did say that he thinks that the principal cause of violence in the state is land scarcity and, as you say, overpopulation. And he insists the only way out is rapid economic development. What do you see as the root cause of this ongoing violence? And tell me a few of the scenes you saw up there, when you were there. Anything that strikes you?
No, I've seen this kind of violence happening in Assam since the 1980s, when there was a huge movement by the ethnic Assamese and some of these indigenous tribes people, demanding detection and deportation of what they believed were foreign nationals. I mean, they meant these Bengali-speaking Muslims, because they said they are Bangladeshis and that they should be thrown out, they should be detected and then deported. And this movement went on for 6 years in the 1980s and led to huge violence in one day. And I remember this as a junior reporter having covered this ethnic rioting in a village called Nelly, where 1,800 Muslims were killed in one day.
And what that was? That was in the '80s.
Yeah, 1983. I remember the date, February 16, 1983. This was one of the
terrible
worst days for modern India, because 1,800 of these people were killed by the indigenous Tiwa tribesmen, Lalung tribesmen, in a matter of about 6 hours. Now the point is, ever since then, this violence has erupted from time to time, as you rightly said, and as the chief minister rightly says, everyone knows what the problem is. The problem is too many people, too little land, and very little alternate employment opportunities, you know, because this is a region which is hardly industrialized even by Indian standards, and therefore the primary occupation is agriculture, animal husbandry, and fisheries, and for that you need land. So there's huge competition on land. Assam has one of the highest land, population density in the country, and the problem is that there's very little alternative employment and very little, mobility of the population, in the sense that, you know, people are not really moving out of agriculture into industries. So land is crucial. But along with land is this whole question of political power, because over a period of time, these Bengali-speaking Muslims have become very important in Assam's electoral politics. Out of the 126 seats in the Assam State Assembly, there's something like one-third of, you know, these seats, which are directly dependent on what you can call the Muslim vote, you know. So political parties woo these people, and that upsets a lot of these indigenous ethnic communities who feel that they have been marginalized in their own sort of homeland, and that leads to this kind of violence from time to time.
So do you think this this conflict could have an impact on the midterm elections coming up?
Well, of course, you know, I mean, if this conflict cannot be properly controlled, one thing for sure, the ruling Congress in Assam, which depends so much on the Muslim vote for electoral victories, are going to lose out to a new Muslim party which has come up in the last sort of 6 years, which has slowly increased its strength in the state assembly. They now have 16 seats. They are the principal opposition party. See, apart from the Congress, which rules the state, it's this party, the Assam United Democratic Front, which is this party of these Muslims, which is the principal opposition party. They have 16 seats. And some of these other ethnic parties, you know, which represents the Assamese or the tribals, they don't get into double figures. So these people have become very important in terms of political power, and therefore some of these indigenous communities, especially in areas where they have some population, they believe that, you know, these people should be thrown out. And that has created situations in which some of the armed militant groups representing the tribes, such as the Bodos, have actually resorted to ethnic cleansing. That's what has happened before. That's what has happened this time. What I've seen there in this region is very systematic ethnic cleansing attempted by the Bodo militant groups, such as the National Democratic Front of Bodoland, the NDFB. They are saying that all these Muslims have been driven out, will not be allowed, even as the government says that we are trying to send all these people back home so that normalcy comes back. We have brought in troops, we have brought in the Indian Army, we brought in paramilitary troops, police.
Yeah.
But the militants are saying that they will only allow people to return to their villages if their Indian citizenship is proved beyond doubt. And they are the people who are going to decide it, which means what? Which means that none of these Muslims are feeling secure enough to go back to their own villages. And therefore, this huge internal displacement problem, nearly 500,000 people in camps, continues to remain. And this creates its own tensions.
Yeah, let's talk about another kind of a new twist on what's been happening up there. The social media angle, these messages that circulated through mobile networks and the social media this month that compelled thousands of northeastern natives to flee the cities where they work or go to school and return home. For example, I understand one post showed multiple bodies and claimed them to be victims of the Assam clashes, but they were actually bodies from the scene of an earthquake. Have there been do you see this as fanning the flames?
Well, that's true. The social media has been used by some interested elements. It's very difficult to say who they are. The Indian government first very promptly blamed some sites in Pakistan, but we're not terribly sure. But some interested quarters definitely sort of, you know, circulated these messages, as a result of which Indian Muslims for the first time You know, Muslims who are Indian nationals, people based in Bombay, Bangalore, South Indian states, where there are a large number of Northeastern natives who work in, you know, information technology sector, other industries. In these places, the Muslims were upset when they got these messages. There was a very concerted effort, and it's difficult to say who is behind it, but there was a very concerted effort to provoke Muslims in some of the Indian cities where there is a large section of Northeastern natives. And right. Then what happened? First, it started with Bombay. There was a big rally there with the local Muslims, you know, protesting against the violence in Assam. It turned violent. Police had to open fire. And then there was a flood of hate mails and messages to Northeastern natives, which created a panic, as a result of which many of them fled. You know, cities like Bangalore, cities like Hyderabad, cities like, you know, Bombay, where a large number of them are. Now, this itself is a huge tragedy. I would call it an integration of conflict. You know what? At one point of time, David, very few people from Northeast would actually go out to work. You know, in the 1950s and 60s, I mean, young people would join underground movements and fight against India. Now, the very descendants of those people have now realized that India is an emerging dream. It's big economy and all that. You know, it's a land of opportunity. You know, it's not quite the American dream, but India is also sort of, you know, attracted people, I mean, from places like Northeast to areas of development where there has been considerable economic growth through things like information technology. You know, right. Bangalore, our own Silicon Valley, these kind of places. Now, these people in Northeast, because of traditional missionary education provided by the Christian church, they're pretty good at English, that they are employable people, and therefore, a large number of them have actually migrated to these cities in southern India and western India, where there's considerable economic growth. This is part of the big economic boom,
right,
post-1990. And therefore, their population has grown. Only in Bangalore, there's something like about a quarter of a million of these people, you know, working in various capacities in information technology firms, you know, right from being programmers to security guards to what have you. Now, these people, when they were targeted, you know, hate mails, and some of them were actually attacked because they look very different from, you know, people in the Indian mainland. They look more East Asian, they look
right.
more Chinese, they look more Nepali, which is why in many other parts of India, derisively, they are sometimes called chinky, you know?
And Sabir, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week, we have an interactive map of India and an interactive timeline spanning from when India gained its independence from Britain in 1947 to the modern-day conflicts among its diverse ethnic groups. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. Now, Sabir, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
Well, I'm actually from the northeastern state of Tripura. This was a princely kingdom, you know, even during the British, this was never subjugated, this state. It's a small state below Assam, actually. You know, on three sides of it is Bangladesh, and I'm, of course, of Bengali origin, but my great-great-grandfather, he came to Tripura to work for the king of Tripura, and then, of course, we have lived there, but we are very old settlers. Now, the point here, that exactly is the point. You know, in one sweeping, you know, brush, there are indigenous groups who would call these Bengali Muslims, or Bengali Hindus for that matter, anybody from eastern Bengal, now Bangladesh, as Bangladeshi. But most of these people, I would imagine, came to this region much before Bangladesh emerged as a separate country in 1971, when it broke away from Pakistan after a very bitter, bloody civil war. So if people have come from this area into Assam, into Tripura, into other parts of Northeast in the 1930s, 40s, or 50s, and now you say that they're Bangladeshis and they need to be thrown out, that's a huge problem. You see, David, in 1979 when this movement started, and in 1985 it was finally settled through an agreement between the agitating All Assam Students' Union and the Indian government. The All Assam Students' Union, when they signed on the dotted lines, they agreed that 1971 is the cutoff date. 1971, 26th March. Anybody who has come into Assam or the Northeast before that date are Indian nationals.
Right.
Indian citizens. I mean, they're not foreigners. Anybody who's come after that, foreigners. But now, you know, whenever you see someone with a skull cap and a beard, and you think, oh, this man is from Bangladesh, many of them are actually people who are originally from there, but have come long time back. And they have lived in Assam. In fact, in Assamese society, there is a word called Nokhomia, New Assamese. You know, these Muslims, because they are poor farmers, they are just interested more in land than in culture or linguistic identity. When they came, they migrated from what is now Bangladesh into Assam. They willingly gave up Bengali culture and language. They adopted Assamese culture. They accepted Assamese as their mother tongue. And even today in the census that is held in India every 10 years, they write their mother tongue as Assamese. But maybe they speak Bengali at home because that's their original native language. So here now, there is an attempt to brandish, or to, you know, sweep all of them with a single brush and say they're all Bangladeshis.
Right.
That actually creates and compounds the problem.
Now, talking about compounding the problem, do you think this could erupt into something bigger in the future? More.
Of course, this could, because it's not just the Bodos. Earlier, there have been movements by the ethnic Assamese against these settlers. Now the Bodos. Sometimes it has been the Tiwa tribesmen, sometimes it has been the Rabha tribesmen. Now this is threatening to spill over to other states. In Nagaland, the Naga tribes, who have fought against the Indian government for a very long time in one of South Asia's longest ethnic separatist insurgency. Now in Nagaland, the Naga tribes, their organizations are also saying that a large number of these people are here in our state. They have to be identified and thrown out. And the word they use is illegal Bangladeshis. In Meghalaya, which is another state just below Assam, local tribal groups are saying their numbers have grown in our state, they need to be thrown out. Now, the problem is that when you target a community like this, you forget about laws, you forget about agreements, you don't check whether somebody has come before 71 or after 71. You see a man with a beard and a skull cap, you think he's Muslim, and he looks slightly different from the local tribesmen. He doesn't look exactly Chinky or East Asian. He looks more like a Bangladeshi, so he has to be thrown out.
And
point here is, if he has come before 1970, when your organizations are signed on the dotted line with the government of India saying that they should be Indian nationals.
You've made the comparison that this could lead to a situation similar to Bosnia or Lebanon. Can you explain why there's a comparison there?
Why I said Lebanon is, in Lebanon, you know, the conflict became so complicated and the situation so fluid that in the afternoon, X and Y were together against Z. But in the evening, X and Z have got together and they're fighting Y. You know, this changes. Now, in Assam, for instance, at one point of time, the ethnic Assamese were more upset with the Bengali Hindus, who they thought were educated and were their competitors in areas of education, employment, trade.
Mm-hmm.
And these Muslims, Bengali Muslims, because they had adopted and accepted Assamese language, they were called Neo-Assamese and they were accepted in Assamese society because they're harmless farmers or doing menial jobs. Now, because their numbers have grown, You know, the Assamese Hindus, they think that the Bengali Hindus are not a problem because their numbers are small.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that comes this big Hindu nationalist politics from the Indian mainland, the BJP and all its other branches. And they say Assamese and Bengali Hindus should get together and they should fight this big Muslim influx from Bangladesh. So anybody who is, you know, a Bengali Muslim is actually an infiltrator or an illegal migrant, he should be thrown out. The problem is, if you harp on these identities and see an essential conflict in it, as is the case now, then mm-hmm. of course these conflicts will continue to fester, and depending on who is more powerful where, and who is the main enemy and who is the main contradiction, you know, there will be very confused patterns of conflict all across the region.
Right.
The only common factor that will remain is that there, you know, that these Muslim settlers will be targeted. So what was essentially an ethnic conflict before will now turn into a larger religious conflict that has affected South Asia for such a long time, ever since the partition.
And so, what the, kind of, in just very briefly, what can the Indian government do to try to quell this conflict?
Well, the Indian government will have to be very tough. You know, the bottom line should be for the administration that no troublemaking is going to be tolerated. You know, nobody can say X is an illegal migrant and will have to be thrown out.
Right.
You know, when there's an illegal migrant from Mexico coming into the United States, it's left to the law enforcing agencies to actually find him out and deport him if that's the case. Do people take law into their own hands and beat these people up or attack them? You know, that's usually not the case. So here in India, you know, the law enforcing agencies will have to prevent this, you know, ethnic militias and, you know, pressure groups, which have become very powerful, and they have to be very clearly told that your sentiments are appreciated, your concerns are appreciated, but if you take law into your own hand, as has happened in Assam this time, you know,
right.
Lawmakers who represent certain political parties, indigenous parties in the assembly, going out with AK-47 rifles, leading mobs to attack Muslims. I mean, that cannot happen. That will lead to complete breakdown of governance. So Indian government will have to ensure a return to proper governance, the restoration of peace, basic law and order has to be restored. And then you address the major issue about how you tackle this problem, you know, economic growth, development. But the economic growth and development
right.
that the chief minister is talking about will not be possible if there is a continuous sort of, you know, conflict, which my good friend Sanjeev Barua, he's asking me
so Subir, we're running out of time. I just kind of wanted to summarize it. Basically, you're talking about having a stronger central government reaction. But we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. And thank you very much, Subir, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Sravani Pair was our lead producer. Join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.